This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ever been a parent? Ever been the child of a parent? If you answer yes to at least one of these questions, then you already know something about the psychological concept of attachment, but probably not as much as you'd like to. Or how do attachment issues still affect you all these years or decades after leaving childhood behind? How are attachment concerns affecting the children in our world at this very moment? And what might that mean for their future? Dr. Bob Marvin first began seeking answers more than 40 years ago. His work has garnered international acclaim, but since he's still discovering new insights into this most mysterious of psychological functioning, we figured it would be good to hear some of what he's been learning lately. So we will, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. It is called the Mary D. Ainsworth Child-Parent Attachment Clinic. Based in Charlottesville, it was founded more than 20 years ago as an outgrowth of an idea developed by a psychologist who had been in on the ground level of revolutionary research into a concept known as attachment. Why not, this particular psychologist thought, create a place where we can not only continue our research, but can use what we've been learning in a clinical setting in order to help actual clients who are struggling with a variety of difficulties? Well, that therapist is with us today. He still serves as a research professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia, as well as professor emeritus at UVA's medical school. But by far his biggest focus and maybe his greatest joy is his continuing work as executive director of that Ainsworth Attachment Clinic, Dr. Robert Marvin. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, Bob, I have so many questions for you, and I have found talking to you in the past so fascinating. What is attachment, and why, in your mind, is it so important?
Okay. What are attachments? That's kind of a complex question. I think there are two main ways we can know an answer. First of all, attachments are basically the love relationship between a child and a parent. This is something that's been going on for 60 million years in various species, ending up, of course, and in some sense culminating with the human attachment relationship between child and parent. I think there are, like I say, two ways to think about it. One is all of us have been through it, and we know about attachments intuitively. We know about them instinctively. Our brains are wired to know about attachments. And another way is to think about them and ask the question in a way that allows us to conceptualize what it is, to talk about it and study it and know about it in a way that's shared in a language, using words and concepts, in a language that's shared between people. But I think the more important way to start is to think about it from that intuitive sort of approach. And I think the best way to do that would be just to tell a couple little stories. Each of them are things that each of us has either, well, we've been through it ourselves, and we may remember it, or it may have happened when we were young enough that we don't really remember it, but we have experienced it maybe with our own children or with our younger sibs or something like that. Just imagine a four-year-old or a three-year-old child, a little bit beyond toddlerhood, and this little boy and his mom are outside walking down the sidewalk in the neighborhood, and they're just meandering along, and the mom is sort of walking along slowly, and the child is exploring everything that he comes upon, picking up all kinds of stuff, and mom is watching him pretty carefully to make sure that he doesn't pick up something that's too dirty or too dangerous. And they're walking down the street, and around from the back of a house comes running toward them this large dog, growling and running right at them. What does that child do? Well, how does that child feel? Just imagine, I think all of us can imagine how that child would feel, and the rush of adrenaline and the fear. And what does that child do? That child immediately turns and runs to the mom. The mom is his attachment figure. The mom is his protector. If something goes wrong, I know where to go and I run to my mom. The mom, of course, is also feeling some fear for her child, and rushes to the child, picks the child up, and the mom is able to protect the child from the dog, or at least keep the child from the dog. What would happen, though, if all of a sudden the mom disappeared? And that's a topic for a little bit later in this conversation, perhaps. But that attachment, that incredibly strong emotional bond, where when something goes wrong, the child immediately rushes to the parent for protection. And will even run to the parent if by some chance the parent has gotten between the child and the dog. The child doesn't run away from the dog. The child runs to the parent. And that's really what attachments are about, is that kind of protection. Okay, that's half of it. The other story is somewhat different, but still very much related to this attachment. And that's, now let's think about a 5-year-old child, let's say, who wants to learn how to ride a 2-wheel bike without training wheels. That's a pretty exciting thing for a 5-year-old. But it's also in some ways a bit of a scary thing, because what if I fall? What if I can't stay up? And what if I fall and I hurt myself? Well, typically what happens in that kind of a situation, we all remember this, either our dads or moms doing this with us or us doing it with our kids. Child gets on the bike. Dad is holding the seat, standing right behind the child and to the side of the bike, and they start to move. And the dad says, okay, Johnny, when you're ready, just tell me to let go. I'm going to hang on. I'm going to keep you from falling until you're ready, and then I'll let go when you tell me. And so they start moving faster and faster, and the dad says, you ready? Child says, no, Daddy, not yet, not yet. And then they keep moving a little bit longer, and the child then says, okay, let go, and the dad lets go. But the dad also keeps running right alongside the bike with his hand just inches from the back of the seat so he can grab it if need be. But he doesn't have to, because the child is successful in keeping the balance. And that gives that child such a sense of competence and such a sense of accomplishment. And that dad was such an important part of that experience and that first time that I ever rode the bike without my training wheels on it. So attachments are really about those two things in one sense. One is protecting the child, and how the child uses the parent as a protector when something goes wrong, and also as a help and support in learning to explore and becoming more competent at any number of skills that we develop during our lifetime. That's what attachments are really about, are those two things.
You met Mary Ainsworth in, was it 1963 at Johns Hopkins?
1963, when I was an undergraduate student. No, I was a sophomore.
So you were like 19, 20 years old.
Yeah, 19.
And within a fairly short period of time, you began working for this woman who would become legendary in this field on one of her landmark studies.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
It was amazing. I had no idea what was happening in my life. I just really had no idea who I just, I took a course from this woman, this professor, a course in child development. And she had been working in this area for about 10, 15 years, working with John Bowlby, who was the, John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. John Bowlby was a psychiatrist in England and a researcher, actually a theorist is what he really was. And he and Mary Ainsworth had been working together in this area. She had gone from England to Africa to do a project where she was watching mothers and babies, watching the babies grow up, going into the homes, watching these babies grow up.
In tribal villages in Uganda.
In tribal villages in Uganda, that's right. And watching these babies grow up for their first year of life, studying what she and John Bowlby were starting to call attachment, but what they really knew, they were studying the development of love between a baby and a parent. She came back to the U.S. got a position at Johns Hopkins and decided to do a similar project, a more advanced version of it, in Baltimore. And that's when I met her, is when she was starting that project. I started working with her as an undergraduate research assistant, and I was so lucky to be able to be one of the people who got into the homes and followed these babies, going into the homes, observing and taking notes, and coming back in and writing these long reports on what I had seen. And she had taught us how to watch and how to take notes and that sort of thing. And was able to watch this sample of 26 children, babies, from birth through the end of the first year. And most of my time at Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate was spent working, in addition to coursework, of course, working on that, working and having a good time, working on that project. And that's set the stage for me for the rest of my life. And to think that I was searching around for a major, and to find something where there was this future for me, a career where I could get paid and have a real career to play with babies. Oh, my goodness. That was just incredible. And I've just had that same attitude my whole life, to be able to do this my whole life and get to play with these little kids, who I think are just so cute. It's just wonderful.
Well, as I understand, if we can skip through some of what's happened in this field for you since then, Bob Marvin, when you went and did your graduate work, you sort of progressed from where Mary Ainsworth had started. She had focused on the first year. You
right.
began looking at attachment for young children after the first year.
Right.
Eventually, you would come to the University of Virginia as a faculty member in their psychology department. I think that was the mid-70s.
Early 70s, yeah.
And then through the 80s, you continued your research, but you also, as I understand, Bob Marvin, felt more and more like you wanted to find a way to take what you were learning in all this research and help people with it.
That's right.
Because in addition to a researcher, you were also a therapist.
Right.
And eventually this would lead to the formation, more than 20 years ago, of the clinic that is still based in Charlottesville, named for your mentor, Mary Ainsworth, that is both doing research and treatment.
That's right. That's right. And I've been doing that now since the mid-1980s, and really started the clinic and formed the clinic in the early to mid-90s when I was working as a faculty member in the Department of Pediatrics in the medical school. And eventually retired from the university and set up the clinic out in the private sector. And my partner in this endeavor, Bill Whalen, Dr. Bill Whalen, and I have been running this clinic since then. And a lot of it has been focused on continuing to do research with older kids, older than infancy, who are living in very difficult circumstances. Children, for example.
So we're talking about well over 40 years that you've been exploring your passion of watching babies interact with their parents and learning a whole bunch about this phenomenon called attachment. I've got a whole bunch more questions for you when we get back. And if I was the president, the minute the Congress called my name, I say now, who do you think you're fooling? Right out the president, you see you. I'm up on the presidential podium. My mama loves me, she loves me. She kept on her knees and hugged me. Oh, she loved me like a rock. She rocked me. When Bob Marvin was growing up near Potomac, Maryland in the 1950s, he loved being out in the woods studying nature. He'd watch animals and birds for hours at a time. He says he thought back then that he might grow up to be either an Indian or a physicist. Instead, in just his second year as an undergraduate at Johns Hopkins University, he began taking courses from and working as a researcher for the legendary psychologist Mary Ainsworth. Today, Dr. Marvin continues studying nature, but mostly human nature, as both a research and clinical psychologist and as executive director of the Mary D. Ainsworth Child-Parent Attachment Clinic. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. And in Paul Simon's tale, Bob Marvin, he seemed to be saying, doesn't matter. You can be the president, but if you grew up knowing that your mother loved you like a rock, it doesn't matter what anybody else says or throws at you, you're going to feel secure, is what I get from that song. Is that a fair analysis of what attachment theory shows?
It absolutely does. The kind of, the pattern of, or the type, or the kind of attachment that a child develops early on in the relationship with his parents is a pattern that person carries forward in his life or her life for the rest of her life. And what we know from a lot of longitudinal research, where one of the most exciting kinds of research that's been done in this field is that a team of researchers will start watching babies and parents. Like, there's this one project at the University of Minnesota, awesome project, where they started back in the mid-70s watching these babies and parents, 250 families. And these were fairly high-risk families living in poverty. And they continued to watch these same families, these same babies grow up. The babies grew up. They started having their own babies. And the same team, some of the folks had retired, of course, but basically the same team, continued to watch as these babies had grown up and were now having their own babies and raising their own kids. So they were in a position, they are in a position of answering, at least in a preliminary way, a lot of questions of the sort that you were just posing. And it's pretty clear from their data that if a child has a secure attachment with a parent, as that child grows up, he tends to have secure relationships with other people as well, and grows up, typically gets married, has children, and passes that same pattern on to his or her kids. Another child who grew up in slightly less ideal circumstances and maybe is a pattern of attachment where basically the idea is if you're feeling bad, you deal with it yourself. Don't come to me. But if something really bad happens, I'm there to take care of you. But otherwise, you got to deal with it on your own. That kind of attachment, which is thought of as emotionally dismissing, that child grows up, eventually has children, passes that pattern on to his or her kids. So we pass these patterns of close relationships from one generation to another, in the same way that we pass things like accents, table manners, and other kinds of patterns of social interaction.
Researcher and clinical psychologist Robert Marvin is our guest. First call coming in from Middlebrook. Arthur, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Yes, Dr. Marvin, how does, as a divorced father, I'm wondering, how does one preserve attachment, particularly with smaller children, and how does one recover attachment if, in fact, it lapses?
Oh, that is such a great question, and it's one that we are challenged by very frequently. But there's good news. The key is making sure that the non-primary custodial parent has a lot of contact with the child. It doesn't have to be overnight contact. Depending on the age of the child, it can be a few hours at a time, a couple of times a week, during the day, as the child gets older and is more comfortable with separations, that child can start spending overnights with a non-custodial or non-primary custodial parent. As long as there is a fair amount of contact, and as long as the interaction between the child and the parent is secure and healthy, that relationship can be and will be a permanent relationship.
Dr. Marvin, one of the things that Arthur, it sounds to me like, hinted at in his question, mm-hmm. is that, as often happens in the period of divorce, is there's so much acrimony between the two parents. Something happens so that one of them is either kept from or unable to be with the child or the children for a significant period of time. And then, as Arthur asks it, if that attachment has been lost for 6 months, a year, can it ever be recovered?
But I would say not only is that attachment not lost, it absolutely is there. Once an attachment is formed, let's say that the mom and the dad continue to live together until the baby is 18 months old, that baby is going to be attached to both parents. That attachment is something that happens in the baby's brain. And those neural networks, they're permanent now, and they stay, and the attachment's going to stay there. So if even with 6 months of no contact, that attachment is still there. It's not totally as simple as that, because the baby, if the father doesn't see the baby for that period of 6 months, when they get back together, the baby's going to be a bit confused and that sort of thing. But the attachment will be there, and it'll be fairly easy to rebond, but rebonding, just that term, sounds like the bond disappeared. And what
so
my point is, the bond does not really disappear. It stays there. And it can be reconsolidated
there may be some hesitancy at first, it seems, but you're saying that the child has the potential to fairly easily get back to once again feeling safe and trusting and loved.
And comfortable with that, yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Arthur, does that address your question?
Yes, it does.
Such a great question. Thank you so much. Next, we're going to Charlottesville. Phyllis, thanks for calling us. Your question or comment, please.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. You know about coincidences and God incidences and such. I was at Plan 9 Music just now, and I happened to see a CD by Whitney Houston. Aha! I have to listen to this on the headphones. There was a song where she was singing about children, that we have to give them love and let them discover what's inside of them. Then they will have dignity, and no matter what happens to them in life, they will feel good about themselves and will have that love inside. I burst into tears. It was the most beautiful song. So I just wanted to share that love is so necessary, isn't it? Yeah, I used to teach parent effectiveness training and realize how much parents want to but don't have the skills sometimes.
Yeah.
So there are ways to get those skills. Thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're right. Again, going back to the research, but this translates so much into real life. What the research in this area is showing is that if a child has a strong and secure love or attachment with her parent, that's the single best and strongest predictor for good outcomes for that child as the child grows up. It's a better predictor for school behavior. It's a better predictor for academic achievement. It's a better predictor for peer group interaction, for choice of partners, than any other measure that the field of developmental psychology has developed, including intelligence. So you're absolutely right that it is just so crucial.
Phyllis, thank you so much for your call. Next to Grotto's Melanie, you're on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for psychologist Bob Marvin, please.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is the opposite of your first caller. Have there been studies done on parents who are overly attached to children and who won't let them make decisions on their own or make mistakes and grow up, basically? And how do you get these parents to see this and to make those changes where their adult children can begin to grow up and not be so attached?
Yes, another really good question. Yes, there has been quite a lot of research on that, except that we would change the focus of how you describe that relationship just a little bit. Those parents who do what you're talking about very, very much love their children. But what tends to happen is... The important thing about an attachment is that the child uses the parent as a secure base from which to explore and develop, and also as a haven of safety when the child is distressed or hurt or scared or something and needs to come back to the parent for soothing and that sort of thing. The relationship that you're talking about there, where the parent gets stuck and where the relationship gets stuck, is when the child wants to move off and explore and really become competent at something, then the parent is pulling the child back and not delighting in the fact that this child is going off and exploring. And what we've learned is that for a lot of parents who are like that, what's going on is when the child moves off away from them to explore, the parent feels, oh, he's leaving me, he doesn't need me. But actually, the child needs the parent every bit as much for exploration as he does, as or she does, as the child does when the child is upset and needs to come back to the parent to be held and soothed and talked to and that sort of thing. So what we do is in working with these families, and actually what we're really doing at that point is working with the parent, is to help them see how important they are to their child even when the child is moving away to explore. And that's something that a lot of parents don't seem to get intuitively, but with some help, they come to see that, and it's a big help to the relationship.
Melanie, does that address your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you for taking the time to join us. Dr. Robert Marvin, longtime researcher into this psychological phenomenon, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Next to Farmville, Wayne, thank you for joining us.
Oh, glad to join you. I have a question regarding the birth of our daughter. When she was born by cesarean, they handed her to me, and I didn't know who that creature was. Mm-hmm. And yet within 24 hours, I found that I had changed so that I would have killed in order to protect her. I'm just wondering, this can't be a unique thing just with me, I'm sure. Is there a name for this, and is it genetic?
Okay, good question. The name for it is depends on who you're talking to, I guess, but it's the love of a parent for the child. It's the caregiver bond. From a scientific perspective, to avoid confusion, we call it the caregiver bond instead of the attachment. The child is attached to the parent. The parent has a caregiver bond with the child. It's all love, but it's the parent's love for a child. And it's an interesting question you ask because it takes a number of months for a baby to become really attached to a parent. And typically that happens in the last quarter or so of the first year of life. And by the time the child is about 18 months, that attachment is really, really consolidated. On the other hand, for parents, it happens so often instantaneously. For a lot of parents, it actually happens before the baby's born. For a lot of parents, it happens like in your case, where it's within a matter of minutes or hours, and you would die for that child, no question. That's how strong that bond is. And in one sense, it is genetic. It's something that's wired into us because in families where, through evolution, in families where the parents reacted that way, that babies were protected better and they were better able to reach adulthood themselves and have and pass that gene on into the next generation and into the gene pool. So, yes, it certainly is genetic. It's very important from a species point of view. Thank you.
Wayne, thanks so much for your call. Getting back to Melanie's question about parents being overly attached, it seems to me that where this research started with Mary Ainsworth and the colleague that you mentioned,
John Bowlby, yes,
earlier, and then when you started working with her and other researchers started working with her, much of it was focused on what happens to the child and how that affects their later life if there's been what would, I guess, be called successful levels of attachment. But in your work today, you study both what's happening with the child and what's happening with the parent?
Yes. Yes.
And tell us a little bit about how the research is done. I think most people probably have heard that if the child feels secure, then he or she is willing to step farther away from the parent and explore. That was sort of in Psychology 101.
Right.
But what else is going on here as you're looking at successful versus not quite so successful parent-child attachment?
Well, again, if you think about attachments as trying to talk about it in a way that is not too technical, children use their parents as a secure base to move off to explore, and as a haven of safety to come back to when they're distressed and need the parent. There are lots of jobs that the parent has while that's happening. And there's been a lot of research identifying a number of different patterns of parenting that either help or sometimes, unfortunately, don't help very much with the child being able to move off and explore. But if you think about, or if you look carefully at the literature, there are four main things that a parent does, that a successful parent does. First of all, the parent monitors the child for safety. Second, the parent, it delights in that little baby or that child and just thinks that child is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Third, the parent helps the child when the child is trying to do something and is challenged and can't get that puzzle to work or can't ride the bicycle without the wheels.
Can you save four?
I can save four.
The brakes come up in a few seconds. And if you there on the other side of your radio, stay tuned. We'll get to number four in about 60 seconds.
I believe the children are our future. Teach them well and let them lead the way. Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. I decided long ago.
Charlottesville-based psychologist, attachment researcher, and director of the Ainsworth Child-Parent Attachment Clinic, Bob Marvin, is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So you were listing four of the critical things a parent does when a child is moving away because it feels safe.
Yes.
So go over the first three quickly, right, if you would, again, and right, then we'll get to the all-important fourth.
Right. When the child is moving away to explore and using the parent as a secure base, and if the parent can do these four things, if the parent can watch over the child for safety, monitor the child for safety, delight in what the child is doing, and I can't focus too much on that. I hope we get a chance to come back and talk more about that. To help the child when the child is stuck or challenged in doing what the child is trying to do, not do it for the kid, but just help him just enough so the kid gets unstuck, so to speak. And then finally, sometimes just be the child's playmate. Just have a good time. If a parent can do those four things when the child is moving away from the parent, using the parent as a secure base, then that's good enough parenting. That'll work. You're going to have a secure child when the child is moving away to explore. Now, when something happens and the child is scared, hurt, tired, whatever, that will shut down exploration. The child's attachment behavior is activated. The child comes to the parent. And the parent has another four jobs at that point. The parent's jobs are protecting the child from danger. Think back to that example about the dog that we talked about early in the show. Again, delight in me. I don't mean delight in the child's distress, but just I'm so delighted to be able to help you as your mom or your dad. Soothe me, or to soothe the child. If the child is really distressed, to help the child get downregulated, to help the child get soothed and calmed, because little kids don't have very good strategies for doing that on their own. That's really crucial. And then finally, help the child get reorganized. And by that I mean when little kids get really upset, their behavior gets disorganized and dysregulated, and so do their feelings, so do their emotions, and help the child get reorganized. If the parent can do those four things when the child is distressed and can't explore and needing the parent, that's good enough parenting, and that child will have a secure attachment to the parent. If the parent can do all of those when the child is exploring and when the child needs help, and that's eight things the parent has to do in a sense, that's a bit oversimplified, of course, but if the parent can do those eight things, then that's going to be good enough parenting. The child's going to be secure. Those are the really eight really important variables, with the addition of a couple of other things like knowing when to take charge.
So we'll get to more of that.
Okay.
We've got some people who've been waiting on the line, right. And I think Allison in Harrisonburg is waiting the longest. Allison, thank you for your patience. Your question or comment for Dr. Bob Marvin, please.
Yes, thank you. I'm the youngest of five children, and I wondered if you could comment on how birth order affects the level of attachment.
Interesting. There's not been as much research on that as I think there's going to be over the next few years. But based on, all of us have the experience of living in families. A lot of us I was one of five sibs myself. And there is a little bit of research on it suggesting that, not all five kids are not extremely likely to have the same pattern of attachment to their parents. In other words, an oldest child may have a somewhat different pattern of attachment or quality of attachment, or be a little bit more secure or less secure than the second, third, fourth, or fifth child in the sibling group. There's a lot of lore about this, where the oldest child, especially in a large family, is going to tend to be the one who's assigned more responsibility. The youngest child is the one who's always going to, even at age 35, is still the baby of the family, and has some of those characteristics. The middle child is often the lost child. But that's more lore, as far as I know. That's more lore than it is real scientific knowledge. What we do know scientifically is that you cannot predict really clearly from one child to another whether that child is going to be secure or not. Families are very complex things, very complex systems.
I'm just curious, Allison. Do you have a theory based on your experience of being the youngest?
I think that my older siblings had a deeper attachment to both of my parents. I had a very deep attachment to my mother and maybe less so to my father. And I wondered I tend to be very independent, and I see my older siblings having maybe a more dependent kind of attachment to my parents. And I just wondered, if perhaps in growing up that I became more independent because out of necessity.
Yeah, that's very possible. There's what we know is that those kinds of differences within families are really, really common. And we know something about what leads to a more dependent relationship, what leads to one that is sort of on the other, toward the other end of the continuum, like you describe yourself, and like I would describe myself too, for that matter. And we also know that that children may have a different kind of attachment to their mom than they do to their dad. I mean, you know, that all of us have experienced that. Any grandmother could tell you that, in a sense. But you cannot predict the security or the pattern of the child's attachment to the father by knowing what the child's attachment is to the mother. So, and one
or
of the big lessons
point,
there,
by birth order, or
by birth order. But we do know that children who have those different kinds of attachments, they have had a different experience than their sib did, or than they did with their dad.
Allison, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here on Virginia Insight. So let's get back to what you were trying to emphasize before as an additional point that you think is important, that in addition to all of this nurturing and helping the child feel secure and know that the parent delights in the child's presence, the parent also has to know when to take charge.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Right. Well, we think about there are times when parents really need to take charge in the relationship or in the interaction with a child, and there are times when the parent really needs to, in a sense, follow the child's lead. If a child is playing and the parent is in the room with the child and the child is playing with toys, the parent's job at that point is let the kid be in charge of what I'm playing with and of what he's playing with or she's playing with, and the parent follow the child's lead. At the same time, the parent is monitoring the child, and if the child starts to do something that might be dangerous, then the parent needs to move in and take charge. On the other hand, if the child is upset about something and needs to be soothed, that's not a time for the parent to let the child sort of be in charge. That's a time for the parent to take over and be in charge and take care of business.
Bob and Marvin, one of the things that I found fascinating about the work that goes on at your clinic, the Mary Ainsworth Child-Parent Attachment Clinic in Charlottesville, is that parents often come in knowing that there's a problem with a particular child. They know that they're going to be watched by researchers and psychologists, and they know that they're going to talk to a therapist at some point, and they're kind of scared that this is all my fault.
Yes.
And in fact, what they often end up getting is a lot of reinforcement for the things that they're doing right and they're not giving themselves credit for.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I mean, there is such a tendency. Maybe it's just in our culture. Maybe it's something that's just part of being a parent. If something's not going well, there is this tendency to blame ourselves. And of course, if I'm going in and my child is having a problem, then I'm worried that really the finger is ultimately going to be pointed at me. I'm going to be identified as the problem. And what we know from so much research and so much clinical work is that, first of all, it's perfectly expectable. Join the club. That's what parents are going to think. That's what we would all think. And one of our jobs as an evaluator and as a clinician trying to help is to help show the parents how, and we do this by doing videotaping of parents and children interacting, and then we can go back and review the videotapes with the parents. One of the first jobs we do is go in and review videotapes showing the parent what a good job they're doing in so many ways.
Very concrete specifics.
With very, very concrete specifics, showing them particular points on the videotape where they're obviously doing a very good job. And if you watch the child's expression, the expression on the child's face, the child is so appreciative.
And sometimes just their gaining confidence from knowing that helps them move into other areas where they can get better.
That's right. because
let me stop you because we're going to run out of time, and Cliff has been waiting on the line from Newmarket for quite a while. Cliff, we are short on time, so if your question or comment could be quick, that would be a big help.
Well, I can make the question quick, and I'm not sure how quick the answer will be, so
okay.
I'll get down to it. Work with people with intellectual disabilities. They are adults. Some of the people that we work with have not had a very healthy attachment to their parents. And, of course, that plays into how their life is now. What can we do to help to sort of deal with that for them?
To help the parents who have limited functioning?
The adults who we're working with who have intellectual disabilities.
Right.
Who have not had a very positive attachment with their parents.
Okay. Right. Well, we've worked with a lot of families where that is the same situation. For 20 years, I worked at the Kluge Children's Rehabilitation Center, where we were dealing with children and families where there were very significant limitations of a wide range. In the kind of situation you're talking about, two things occur to me. Well, first of all, what really occurs to me more than anything else is, in order to answer the question, it would be important to be able to do a thorough evaluation. But putting that to the side for a moment, two things occur to me as very common answers here. You've probably already do both of them. But one of them is a parent who is limited as much and perhaps even more than a parent who's really not limited, in order to be able to do a good job, needs a healthy relationship with somebody. If that parent didn't have a very healthy attachment, very healthy relationship with her own parent, to be working with somebody, whether it's a therapist or her grandmother or husband or best friend, coach, it doesn't matter. That parent who had that not so happy early relationship, if she can have a good, steady, trusting, secure relationship with somebody at this point, that goes a long way to helping out. The second thing that occurs to me that we do so often is when you have somebody who is limited, that person needs, in a sense, a prosthetic for that limitation. In the same way that a crutch can serve or a wheelchair can serve as a prosthetic for somebody with a locomotor limitation, somebody with an intellectual limitation needs to be hooked up with somebody, needs to have a relationship with somebody who is both sensitive and willing to help the parent, that limited parent, think through the different things, the decisions that she has to make and making choices and that sort of thing, to help that parent think that through.
Cliff, thank you so much for your call. And I'm so sorry that we've got less than a minute left, but I got to get to a little bit more of this because I've heard you say before, Dr. Bob Marvin, that delight on the part of a parent and the parent showing it in such a way that the child sees the delight in the parent's eyes is so important, a psychological developmental experience for young children. For people who had difficult childhoods and now their parents or their grandparents, I know you delight in your grandchildren. Is the experience of loving delight towards others something that can help people as adults heal from negative experiences as children?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That may be the answer to the question.
Well,
we'll have to have you back to... But I've heard you say before that this whole issue of delight cannot be overstressed.
That's right. We tend to think about the kind of delight that we have toward our children, and developmental psychologists thought for a long time that the delight that parents show toward the children is sort of frosting on the cake.
But it's not.
And what Mary Ainsworth showed was
cake.
It is not. It is the most, it's the core of the cake. Absolutely.
Our guest has been the director of the Mary Ainsworth Child Parent Attachment Clinic, professor of research psychology at the University of Virginia and professor emeritus at UVA Med School, Dr. Bob Marvin. Bob, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to our Virginia Insight page, you'll find links to more information about the work that Dr. Marvin is doing. Thank you so very much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.